British Sky Broadcasting presents Lars von Trier's Antichrist, voiced by Neville Watchhurst on behalf of MCS Agency. The titles appear as if scrawled by hand. Antichrist. The T of Antichrist is the female symbol. Antichrist Prologue. In black and white and slow motion, a man's hand turns on the tap of a shower. The man's piercing eyes gaze intently out from his gauntly lined face. Opposite him, a woman stands beneath the jet of the shower, the droplets so distinct that each tiny globule seems to be its own source of diamond-clear light. She gazes back at the man equally intently. Steam curls towards the vent axia. In another room, a window swings open, admitting swirls of snowflakes. The couple now embrace, naked beneath the shower. A startlingly intimate close-up of the shaft of the man's penis moving back and forth between the woman's legs. Her eyes close and her mouth opens in passion. She knocks from the shelf one of three glasses containing the smallest of three toothbrushes. They move together now into a kitchen area. The man lowers her down against the washing machine. Her naked buttocks knock to one side a child's wooden shape puzzle. She gasps as they embrace each other tightly against the door to the rotating drum of the washing machine. In a child's bedroom, a small stuffed toy hangs suspended by a helium balloon. A wooden mobile of the moon and stars rotates gently. The couple crash down in ecstasy onto their bed. On a side table sits a baby monitor with the sound turned to off. The light display peaks repeatedly, unheeded. A chubby-faced blonde toddler stands up in his cot, swinging a stuffed teddy bear in his hands. Three tiny metal figures depicting pain, grief, and despair stand on a desktop raked by the snow-laden breeze from the open window. The toddler's feet lower slowly to the floor. Still in the throes of passion, the woman kicks over a bottle of water standing on a table. The stopper is open and crystal-clear water erupts from the neck as it falls. The toddler stands looking up at the open window. He raises the teddy bear so that it peeps up over the sill. The water continues to pour from the upset bottle. The toddler opens a child gate in a doorway. The water bottle tumbles off the table by the bed as the oblivious couple continue their almost sacramental lovemaking. The child watches them from the doorway. The toddler then slowly turns. There is a hint of a mischievous grin on his face, but his dark eyes are serious as he turns them towards the open window. Snow still wafts down onto the figures of pain, grief, and despair. The child purposefully pushes a bent wood chair closer to the table. The couple still embrace, although the storm of their passion now seems to be subsiding. The tiny child now squats on the tabletop, sweeping to the floor the small metal sculptures. The woman's mouth opens in one further gasp of pleasure. The child stands framed in the open window, holding his teddy bear above his head. A shot from above reveals the snowy street several floors below. The child looks up, enraptured at the falling snow. Suddenly, his feet seem to slip from under him. His arms go up, raising the teddy bear high as he falls in slow motion. The expression on his little face is uncannily calm. The woman lies in bed, seemingly exhausted. The child now falls forward and down through the snow-laden air. The man, his eyes closed, his mouth open, breathes hard as he hangs his head. The child continues to fall. 3 feet above him, the teddy bear falls likewise. The woman's face contorts as she climaxes. Her expression could just as easily denote unbearable grief. The child's body, arms and legs outstretched in a star shape, tumbles towards the pavement. Shot from high above, the toddler hits the ground, sending up an aura of snow. The washing machine continues to rotate. Viewed from close up, the teddy bear hits the ground, its limbs and neck twisting with the impact. The woman holds the man tightly, her eyes now open and gazing towards the ceiling in rapture. The tight wad of laundry in the machine has now blossomed out into a great bloom of wet sheets. Scrawled into what seems to be thick frost on glass are the words Antichrist, Chapter 1, Grief. A glass-walled hearse bears a tiny coffin topped with white flowers. The man and the woman follow on foot. He weeps uncontrollably as he stumbles along. She walks a pace or so behind like an unwilling automaton, her face utterly blank. The woman's spirit seems to give out and she collapses in a dead faint. The man turns and rushes back to her. Other mourners crowd around the woman. The faces of the other mourners appear to have been intentionally rendered out of focus. The woman lies in a hospital bed. The man appears through the door to her private room, holding in his hand a bunch of blue flowers. She stirs and looks up as he places these on the side table and sits down by her bedside.
Hey, how are you?
He takes her hand.
Talk about that.
That was yesterday. Today is Tuesday.
So I've been here long.
A month.
Wayne says that my grief pattern is atypical.
I had a talk with Wayne. I think he gives you too much medication, way too much.
Stop it, please. Trust others to be smarter than you.
He's straight out of medical school. He doesn't know what he's doing. I've treated 10 times as many patients as he has.
But you're not a doctor.
No, I'm not. And I'm proud that I'm not when I meet a doctor like him. There is nothing atypical about your grief.
He holds both her hands as she sits dejectedly in a wheelchair.
It was my fault.
What about me? I was there too.
I could have stopped it. You didn't know that he had started waking up lately. I was aware that he would sometimes wake up and crawl out of bed and walk about, just as you thought that he was soundly asleep. He could open the baby gate. He woke up, and was confused.
Hey.
Seemingly now on another day, the man arrives clean-shaven and in a jacket and tie. He pulls off his coat and bends to kiss her, but she strains to avoid contact.
So Wayne says you want me back home. You couldn't leave it, could you? You had to meddle.
This place leads nowhere. On the contrary. Grief. It's not a disease. It's a natural, healthy reaction. You can't just remove it. You mustn't.
Wayne knows you're a therapist. He says you shouldn't treat your own family.
In principle, I agree, but...
But you're just so much smarter, aren't you?
I love you. Nothing hurts more than to see the one that you love subjected to mistakes and wrongs. No therapist can know as much about you as I do.
The action is rendered even more unsettling by frequent little jump cuts which seem to edit out the odd half-second here and there. A sense of nausea also comes from the picture angling slightly or swaying like a ship at sea. The camera now focuses on the glass vase containing the blue flowers and zooms in on their stems, immersed in cloudy water. The zoom continues, creating a sense of being submerged among the huge green stems. The cloudiness of the water now appears as a curtain of brown motes. At home, the man pulls an envelope out of the letterbox. Examining the envelope, he spots the sender's address, King County Medical Examiner's Office, 792 Harborview Avenue, Seattle, Washington State. He stands considering it, and then folds it into the pocket of a hanging coat. Moving through the flat, he spots a toy truck lying on the floor. He stoops and picks it up. He pauses momentarily as he crosses the threshold into the child's room, and then lays the toy down on a table. He passes through to stand by the bathroom door. The woman stands in the bathroom. She turns to look at him, almost as if defiantly. She holds a canister of her medication, from which she now removes the lid, and then pours the pills into the lavatory. She looks back towards him. She now crouches in the living room. He appears in the doorway. He crosses to where she sits. He kneels down and embraces her. He wraps a blanket around her.
Will it just go on and on?
No. No, it'll change.
Will it get any worse?
Yes, it will.
He embraces her again. He now sits up in bed at night. He makes a note on a pad by the bedside and then turns to where she lies next to him. She stirs and looks up to see him smiling down at her.
You've always been distant from me and Nick. Now that I come to think of it, very, very distant.
Okay. Can you give me some examples of this?
Hell, that's not that difficult to understand. Like, last summer, for instance. You were terribly distant last summer. As a father and as a husband. And that was Nick's last summer you missed out on. Too bad. I never interested you. Until now. That I'm your patient. Perhaps I'm not supposed to talk about these things.
There's nothing you can't talk about.
You're indifferent to whether your child is alive or dead.
He looks at her intently but inscrutably.
I bet you have a lot of clever therapist replies to that, haven't you?
Well, actually, it was to honor your wish. You wanted peace to write.
Perhaps I didn't mean it.
What I understood is that you wanted to write alone. That you and Nick were going to go to Eden, just the two of you. That way you could finish your thesis.
But I didn't.
You didn't.
You see? I didn't even know that.
Why did you give up? That's not like you.
The whole project just seemed less important up there. As you said when I talked to you about my subject, glib.
I never called your subject glib.
Perhaps you didn't use that word, but that's what you meant. And all of a sudden, it was glib. Or even worse, some kind of lie.
I see.
No, you don't see. You see a lot of things, but not that.
She suddenly turns to him and begins kissing him passionately. A break of silver-barked trees and saplings, many of which are strangely arched over, stands picked out against the night sky. The woman's eye fills the screen, blinking and moving unsettlingly one way and then the other. Close-ups on the pulse of her throat as she swallows, on her ear, on her breasts. Her hands hang palely lit and twitching. The artery in her neck pulses insistently. Her lips part. A close-up on the hair bunched at the back of her head. She seems to wake, hyperventilating. He enters the bedroom. He sits down on the bed and cradles her in his arms.
Inhale on the count of five. Call me. Just follow me. Do it with me. Inhale on the count of five. Inhale, two, stay with me, I'm going to teach you how to breathe. Inhale, two, three, four, five, hold, two, three, four, five, exhale, two, three, four, good. Imagine you're blowing on your thistle blooms. Calmly, quietly. Yes, that's good.
She is in a summer meadow with her child.
That's very good. I told you there would be a change. You're still mourning that you're in a new phase.
What phase?
Anxiety.
Anxiety.
Yes.
This is physical. It's dangerous.
No, it's not dangerous. Just as your grief wasn't dangerous. The main part of anxiety is physical. Dizzy spells, dry mouth, distorted hearing, trembling, heavy breathing, fast pulse, nausea.
The man now lies asleep. She climbs onto him as if sexually aroused.
Easy. Never screw your therapist. No matter how much your therapist may like it. I know it distracts you, but it's not good for us. Do the breathing. Hold.
He now actually puts a hand over her mouth.
exhale.
Do you love me?
Yes, I do.
Help me.
Light plays disturbingly in a thicket of thorns.
That's what I'm doing.
The woman stands beneath the shower.
Exposure. That's the only thing that really works. Everything else is just talk. You have to have the courage to stay in the situation that frightens you. And then you'll learn that the fear isn't dangerous. Let's make a list of things you're afraid of. At the top, we put the situation you fear the most.
But I don't know what I'm afraid of.
Just take your time.
I'm thinking.
Okay.
I'm thinking, but can't I just be afraid without a definite object?
The woman dashes into the bathroom. Turning on the light, she leans, breathing heavily over the basin. She turns on the tap with trembling hands and grabs a glass. Having filled it, she struggles to get it to her lips. She gulps at the water and then drops the glass and splashes water onto her face. She crouches, dressed only in her vest and knickers, sobbing on the floor of the bathroom. Getting to her knees, she smashes her head against the lavatory bowl. He is woken by this and rushes through.
No, no.
He overpowers her and takes her into the bedroom. Together in bed now, he hurriedly pulls down his pants and enters her. They make love with frenetic desperation. They now lie next to each other.
This won't do. Stupidest thing I could do to you. If you can't tell me what you're afraid of, maybe it would be easier for you to tell me where you're afraid. Where would you feel most exposed? What would be the worst place? Apartment.
She shakes her head.
A street, a store, the park, visiting someone, maybe.
She lies in the semi-darkness, thinking seriously as he sits over her.
The woods.
The woods?
Yes.
It's funny because you were the one that always wanted to go into the woods. What scares you about the woods? What frightens you there?
Everything.
Tell me what you think is supposed to happen in the woods. Is it any woods in particular?
I
in. Well, what do you say we put the garden around Eden at the top of the pyramid?
Not quite at the top.
He draws a line across the top of his triangle and inserts a question mark in the sub-triangle. She makes to kiss him.
No. Stop it! Okay.
He fends her off. They play fight as she continues to make her sexual advances. She appears to have painfully bitten his nipple, drawing blood.
It's okay.
I'm sorry. It's okay. I don't know.
A thick canopy of leaves speeds past as if viewed from a train window. Among the foliage appear subliminal flashes of her own screaming face. Her face, now in repose, appears reflected on the inner surface of the train window. She wakes from a doze, sat in the carriage.
We can start by working on your expectations. Close your eyes.
She looks across at him and then obeys.
Feel the seat underneath you. Feel yourself sinking down into it, enfolding you. It's a nice feeling. All you feel is a pleasant warmth and heaviness. Your breath is deep, regular, easy. Now, imagine you're at Eden. Imagine you arrive at Eden through the woods. Tell me, what do you see?
Among moonlit trees, she crosses a bridge in slow motion.
I'm at the bridge. It's evening. Almost no birds can be heard. The water is running without a sound. Darkness comes early down here. I walk into it.
She now walks through bracken dotted with birches and shrouded in mist.
The little deers are hiding among the ferns, as usual.
Is it difficult to walk there?
No, not really. In fact, it's almost okay.
She is now framed by the entranceway to some kind of burrow.
In among the trees, on the slope, is the old foxhole.
How do you feel there?
I can't really tell. Walking through mud.
She walks among a devastation of blasted trees.
The trunk is thick. The tree rots so slowly. It has some strange kind of personality. I've always felt.
She walks up a slope towards a log cabin.
Now, where are you? Are you heading for the cabin?
Yes, I am.
outside you're afraid of. Now look around. No. Lie down on the green.
You want me to lie down?
Lie down on the grass.
On top of all the plants?
Yes, lie down on the plants.
She lies back slowly in the sunlit grass, her eyes closed. Shot from above, laid out full length in the grass, she now blends into the green around her.
No matter what happens, you were there. You did it. Let fear come if it likes. Remember, what the mind can conceive and believe it can achieve.
She sits back in the train seat and runs her fingers through her hair. A taxi crosses a bridge over a broad river deep in woodland. The couple now toil up a steep slope amid tall trees. They carry rucksacks and sleeping bags. Rain seems to be falling through the trees. He walks behind her as if shepherding her. She suddenly breaks into a run and hurries forward to sit on a fallen tree. She pulls off her right boot and sock.
What's wrong?
The ground is burning.
The ground is not burning.
She shows him her reddened foot, glaring at him.
Gotta go.
He helps her back on with her boot. They continue walking, emerging now into a clearing. She turns, seeming to be steeling herself to speak.
I want to lie down. Just for a minute.
Sure. Yeah, we'll take a rest.
He helps her off with her heavy framed rucksack. She stands, her eyes cast down and her expression blank. She now lies on a blanket laid out at the foot of a tree. He sits beside her. He stands now, looking down at her as if uncertain what to do. He hesitates, and then steps away through the trees. Further up the slope, he encounters a strong gust of wind. Something to his left catches his attention. Peering through the branches, he advances cautiously. In a clearing stands a small deer. The man advances, staring intently ahead at the deer. He moves so silently that the animal remains where it is, looking directly at him, its ears flicking. The look of delight and wonder on the man's face suddenly curdles as the animal turns, revealing a partially born fawn hanging limply from its hindquarters. The man looks on in disgusted horror as the deer bounds away, the dead fawn bouncing and dangling obscenely. The screen fades to black. White scrawl on a confused background reads, Antichrist, Chapter 2, Pain, and in brackets, Chaos Reigns. She has woken now, but he is seated in the bracken.
Shouldn't we go on?
Yeah, we should.
They have arrived at the small bridge. She pauses and then carries on towards it. She hesitates again as she climbs the bank towards one end of the bridge, seeming unwilling to reach it. He watches her as she comes level with the handrails of the small wooden bridge. She hesitantly places first her left hand on one rail and pauses, breathing hard. She then, with huge unwillingness, places her right fingertips on the other rail. He continues to watch intently as she seems to be summoning courage. He watches as she bolts across the bridge and away into the woods on the other side. He now seems to be searching for her among the bracken. He stands quite still, looking all around him. He walks along a bank beneath a tall pine tree. He pauses on spotting in the bank the circular entrance to an animal's burrow. He walks on. He comes to the bleached, split trunk of a blasted tree. Beyond this stands the log cabin. He stands by the porch of the cabin. The shot jiggles disturbingly as if filmed from an unsteady handheld camera. The man walks, as if curious, towards an outhouse further up the slope. Stepping up into it, he touches the rough carborundum wheel of a whetstone. He walks further into the shed, noting tools hanging on the walls. He flips closed the lid of a metal toolbox. He now stands on the porch of the cabin. He enters, shrugging off his bags. He peers through into a bedroom where he finds the woman lying on a bed, still wearing her coat. He gently drapes an eiderdown over her. Darkness has now fallen. He places a lantern by where she now lies undressed in the bed and climbs in beside her. He spots a bunch of photos sitting on a shelf and takes them down. Lying in the bed, he leafs through them. They are of their son Nick and of the woman there at the cabin, presumably the previous summer. He lies back, pensive and seemingly sad. They lie together asleep beneath the eiderdown. The man's eyes begin to twitch as he is pulled from sleep by the strange noises. She stirs and turns to him.
It's just the stupid acorns.
Onto the roof falls a shower of acorns. He peers out of the window to see them falling to the ground. Daylight. He surfaces from sleep, his hand hanging out of the partially opened window. His hand is dotted over with small, white, sticky, seed-like objects. Waking more fully now, the man sits up. Noticing his hand, he pulls it back inside. Spotting the curious seeds stuck to his hand, he begins to pull them off feverishly. Calmer, once he has removed them, he closes the window and lies back down, putting his arm around her shoulder as he does so. She appears, dressed in a warm pullover, through the glass of the cabin door. She steps onto the porch, peering down the slope to where the man is picking up a large rock.
What are you doing?
I'm just setting up a little exercise. It's like a game. You cheated me yesterday. Running's no good. You have to really feel the grass. I want you to go from this stone. Pretty scary, huh? You ready?
Yeah.
I'll give you a ride. I put you on the first stone. Stay with it. Here we go. Now put your foot down. I got you. I got you. I'm right here.
I can't do this.
Yes, you can. You can and you will, just like I will. We're going to walk together. We're going to walk together, okay? Now, all right, now breathe. Yeah. We're going to step off the rock. I'm gonna step on that grass. Step down. See, what happened? Nothing. Keep breathing. Keep breathing. I've got you. You're really doing great. Okay? Keep breathing. Five, five, and five. You're almost there. You're almost there. You're doing great.
As if in her mind, a pair of bare feet walk through thorns.
We're there. You were there. There you go. You did it. You learned something. Didn't you?
She nods, then dissolves in tears.
You did beautiful.
He holds her hand and strokes it. She tries to smile. She suddenly looks up, as through the branches of a nearby tree the body of a large featherless chick tumbles to the ground. As it rolls to a halt, it is immediately swarmed by large ants. Its eyelids flicker open and it struggles with its stumpy wing. A hawk swoops down and snatches the chick, taking it up to a branch where it rips into it with its beak. She clutches him. Back in the cabin, she lies in bed. He comforts her as she weeps.
I miss him so much.
He bends down and gently kisses her on the cheek. Later, she sits. He pours wine.
I've been afraid up here before.
Yes, it seems likely.
I just didn't know it was here. I became afraid, and I stopped writing.
What was different the last time?
The woman is cutting out from a photocopied sheet a historical illustration of a line of women being hanged for witchcraft. On the table is a notebook entitled Gynocide, adorned with a grotesque occult scene. She leaps up from her work, looking around with concern. She runs through the meadow, desperately searching. She passes the old foxhole. She comes to the bridge. Returned now to in front of the cabin, she stares around in mounting panic. She climbs the slope towards the tool shed. She pushes open the door to find Nick, seemingly oblivious to the noise, playing happily. She sighs with relief but goes back out to search for the source of the crying. She looks upwards. From up high, the camera takes in a broad view of dense forest extending into the far distance. Irregular vertical lines slowly materialize through the shot of the forest, becoming more definite, until the screen is filled with a close-up of the woman's hair.
You didn't hear Nick screaming.
Apparently not.
And because you experienced something that you can explain rationally, you placed Eden very high on the pyramid chart. Eden was the catalyst that triggered your fear. You jumped to conclusions and tied the emotional event with the place. When you feel threatened, it's natural to react. If the danger were real, your fear would save your life. Because your adrenaline would be used for fight or flight. But what you're experiencing is panic, nothing more. The scream wasn't real.
As he comes back from refilling his wine glass, she runs at him, seeming to break the glass. He struggles to contain her violence.
Stop!
You shouldn't have come here. You're just so damn arrogant. But this may not last. Ever thought of that?
She now sits up in bed or on a sofa, much calmer. He lies by her side.
Oak trees grow to be hundreds of years old. They only have to produce one single tree every 100 years. In order to propagate. It may sound banal to you, but it was a big thing for me to realize that when I was up here with Nick. The acorns fell on the roof then, too. They kept falling and falling and dying and dying. And I understood that everything that used to be beautiful about Eden was perhaps hideous. Now I could hear what I couldn't hear before. The cry of all the things that are to die.
It's all very touching. If it was a children's book. Acorns don't cry. You know that as well as I do. That's what fear is. Your thoughts distort reality. Not the other way around.
Satan's church.
Satan, Jesus.
Nature is Satan's church.
What?
She turns to look at the open window.
Why, there you have him. That was his breath.
He crosses to the sash window above the kitchen basin and closes it against the wind and the continuing shower of acorns. He crosses to his pad and at the top of the triangle inserts the word Satan. He stands looking doomily up at the percussive iron roof and then turns back to the pad and strenuously crosses it out again.
Away from me the last time. He was always out and about. He might have made more of an effort to be there for me.
Viewed from high in the treetops, the tiny child trots, clutching his teddy, through a glade of fir trees starkly half-lit by moonlight. In the cabin, the man opens up the wood-burning stove and sets a fresh fire. The man seems to be having trouble lighting a match, seemingly his last. He searches the shelves. He pats the pocket of his coat. Feeling something in it, he pulls out the large envelope from the medical examiner's office. He tears it open for the first time. He reads the letter inside gravely, crossing to the doorway to the bedroom where she lies apparently asleep. He turns, staring intently towards the cabin door, the right side of his face starkly lit, the left completely in shadow. He now stands outside the cabin, stock still beneath a dense and seemingly inexhaustible shower of acorns, as the meadow grass at his feet is whipped by a strong wind. He now sits on the porch, drinking from an enamel mug. He scratches at the hand which had been covered with the seeds and seems to be pondering darkly. She emerges from the cabin, clutching her rainproof. She does her best to flash him a brief smile and crosses to sit next to him.
You look like you slept well.
Thanks, I did. I just wanted to say how happy I am that you're here. I love you, darling.
She takes his hand and smiles at him.
Did you have a good sleep?
He nods.
I've just been having a lot of crazy dreams.
Dreams are of no interest in modern psychology. Freud is dead, isn't he?
Yeah.
She pulls on her coat and walks jauntily away down the slope, turning to smile back at him before disappearing into the forest. He follows her at a slight distance. She crosses to the old foxhole and crouches down, peering inside.
What are you doing?
Look.
She waves her hand in the opening.
I'm well again.
She stamps defiantly on the walkway of the footbridge. She jumps into the stream and wades backwards.
I'm cured. You're so clever. I'm fine.
She embraces him and then fixes him with an unsettling look.
You can't just be happy for me, can you?
She turns and walks angrily away. He appears unsure of how to react. She strides away through the bracken. He follows very tentatively in her wake. He stops in the path through the bracken. A frond of ferns in the centre sways. It then jiggles rather more insistently. The man's attention is drawn to the fern. He peers across and begins to move slowly towards it. He steps cautiously through the bracken, the fronds brushing against his face as he goes. His eyes narrow slightly as he steps ever closer to the moving frond. A wind springs up from nowhere, riffling strongly through the bracken. The man stands still, peering down into the undergrowth. He bends down cautiously and parts the fern fronds. Nestling on the ground is the form of something seemingly covered in sandy fur. He reaches out his hand. The man recoils as a fox snarls at him. Lying on the ground is what appears to be a newborn fox cub, disentangling itself from slimy afterbirth. It turns its head slowly towards the man, and then opens its mouth to speak.
Chaos reigns.
Titles are scrawled on a chaotic backdrop reading Antichrist, Chapter 3, Despair, and in brackets, Gynocide. The man remains standing in the middle of the bracken. A shower of torrential rain starts suddenly. The man remains standing stock still, but finally turns up the collar of his coat and glances to his left towards the cabin where the woman has gone. He now sits next to where she lies in bed. He glances out at the rain. The rain pelts down, nearly filling two glasses sitting on a wooden bench. An old wooden ladder leans up against the bench. Raindrops pearl from the uprights. The man looks away from the window and up at the wooden ceiling in which is set a trap door. The woman remains sleeping in the bed. The man takes a rainproof from a hook. He fetches the ladder from where it leans against the bench. Coming back into the cabin, he leans the ladder up by the trap door. He lights a paraffin lamp. He climbs the ladder and pushes his way through the trap door into the loft area. He holds the lamp up and peers into the darkness. He moves on through the loft. Passing through a doorway, he pauses, staring up at the wall which is covered with images of women being given absolution prior to being executed, being flayed alive, being burnt at the stake. He passes further on to find more dismal images of torture and mutilation administered to women by sanctimonious men. Water from the roof has seeped through many of the pictures. The man looks down onto the floor to see the woman's notebook entitled Gynocide. Next to it lies a star chart with named constellations. Three of them are pain in the shape of a fox, grief in the shape of a bird of prey, and despair in the shape of a deer. The man turns to the woman's book and opens it up. In the flyleaf is pasted a gruesome picture of a woman crawling on her knees. The body of the book bulges with clippings and is filled with neat, dense handwriting. As the man goes further into the book, the writing becomes less assured, more childlike, and ultimately a four-word-per-page incoherent scrawl. The man looks up. Outside, still with the rain pouring down, two large limbs split from a tree and crash to the ground. Back downstairs, the man is making notes in his pad. He briefly strokes the face of the woman who sits wrapped in a blanket, looking very drowsy.
I'd like to do one more exercise. It's like role-playing. My role is all the thoughts that provoke your fear. Yours is rational thinking.
She glances at him and nods wearily.
I'm nature. All the things that you call nature.
Okay, Mr. Nature. What do you want?
To hurt you as much as I can.
How?
How do you think?
By frightening me.
By killing you.
Nature can't harm me. You're just all the greenery outside.
No, I'm more than that.
I don't understand.
I'm outside, but also within. I'm nature of all human beings.
Oh, that kind of nature. The kind of nature that causes people to do evil things against women.
That's exactly who I am.
That kind of nature interested me a lot when I was up here. That kind of nature was the subject of my thesis. But you shouldn't underestimate Eden.
What did Eden do?
I discovered something else in my material than I expected. If human nature is evil, then that goes as well for the nature of...
Of the women. Female nature.
The nature of all the sisters. Women do not control their own bodies. Nature does. I have it in writing in my books.
The literature that you used in your research was about evil things committed against women, but you read it as proof of the evil of women? You were supposed to be critical of those texts. That was your thesis. Instead, you're embracing it. Do you know what you're saying? I can't work anymore now.
They're in bed making love. She is on top.
me.
What?
Hit me so it hurts.
No.
Hit me, please.
No.
I can't stand this.
I don't want to. I don't want to.
Then you don't love me.
Okay. Maybe I don't love you.
She breaks away from him and runs naked out of the bedroom. She emerges, still naked, onto the moonlit porch of the cabin. She strides away across the grass. He peers out of the window to where she lies among the roots of the oak tree, masturbating furiously. As she writhes, eyes closed, clutching a tree root with her left arm, the man's right hand appears and cradles her left cheek. He takes her head in both his hands and moves his face close to hers. She opens her eyes. He slaps her.
Again. Again.
He climbs on top of her. An 18th century print shows a group of naked women bringing down hail. Her hands now cradle his naked buttocks as they plunge up and down beneath her widespread legs. A close-up on the back of the man's head. As the camera pulls back again, the roots of the oak tree are revealed tangled with moonlit white arms. Dozens of pale female hands protrude as the pair lie there, continuing their grim coupling. Wind shakes the tops of the pine trees.
I'm not going to continue this if you don't listen to me. Good and evil. They have nothing to do with therapy. Do you know how many innocent women were killed in the 16th century alone just for being women? I'm sure you do. Many. Not because they were evil.
I know. It's just sometimes I forget.
The evil you talk about is an obsession. Obsessions never materialize. It's a scientific fact. Anxieties can't trick you into doing things you wouldn't do otherwise. It's like hypnotism. You can't be hypnotized into doing something you wouldn't normally do, something against your nature. Do you understand me?
Yeah, I think so.
You think so? Well, you don't have to understand me. Just trust me.
She raises her eyes to him briefly, but then lets them fall as if reflecting to herself that he is her real problem. She rolls paper for the wood burner. In the pile is the letter from the medical examiner's office. She picks it up and crosses to him.
What's this?
It's from the medical officer. It's a copy of the autopsy report.
The autopsy? Did they perform an autopsy?
I didn't want to tell you because you weren't feeling well.
Well, what did they find?
Nothing that would have any bearing on the case. The only abnormality in the victim is a slight deformity of the bones in his feet of an earlier date. We do not attach any significance to this.
The man, as he reads the letter for the first time, pulls out a copy of an X-ray of the child's foot. The angle of the foot makes it appear more goat-like than human. The man now crosses to the woman, holding out one of the snaps from the previous summer.
You aware that you put Nick's shoes on wrong in this picture?
It's a rare. How weird. Slip of the mind that day. How weird.
The man hurriedly leaves the cabin and walks out into the thick mist in the clearing. She looks towards where he has gone. He walks up to the tool shed and goes through the door. He flicks through the whole bunch of photos. In each one, the child appears to have his shoes on the wrong feet. The woman sits in a sunlit meadow, tying the child's shoelaces up. The man looks around as if cornered. He finds an old drawer into which he thrusts the snaps. He takes out a piece of paper which he unfolds to reveal the triangle. At the base is written leaves, trees. Next up, woods. Then Eden. At the top is a question mark and the two crossed out suggestions nature and Satan.
Herself.
He writes me.
I'm not. I'm helping you.
You're leaving me, are you?
She rips open his belt, grabs his penis and gets on top of him. His face contorts as if in pain as she begins to rise and fall.
I love you.
I don't believe you. I don't believe you. I don't fucking believe you.
She has brought down the end of a cut log hard into his groin, seemingly causing him to pass out. He lies there, still breathing, but unconscious. She gasps in exhaustion as she lies by his side. She rouses herself. As she pulls herself up, she spots his still erect penis lying across his belly. She begins masturbating him. Blood finally spurts from the end of his penis. She registers that she has sprayed blood onto her own shirt. She looks down at her own blood-smeared hands. She takes a wrench from the metal toolbox. She goes out to the grindstone and unscrews the winding handle. Removing the heavy stone wheel, she brings it back into the shed and kneels by his prone legs. She raises a hand drill with a fearsome 3/4-inch bit. She presses the point against his lower left leg and begins to drill. Blood oozes out. She removes the drill and prods her right index finger into the wound. He remains lying there, oblivious. She turns to the grinding wheel with its foot-long metal spindle at its centre and raises it up. She now walks, dressed only in her shirt, down the misty path towards the cabin. She slings the wrench beneath the wooden building. She looks around and then wanders away down the path. In the shed, the man comes round into shock. He appears to feel deeply chilled. The whetstone is now securely bolted through his lower left leg. He grips the stone, trying desperately but in vain to loosen the nut on the spindle.
Ah,
He laboriously pulls the metal toolbox down from the bench above him. He searches frantically through the tools. Giving up, he begins to crawl towards the door. Through the door now, he casts a nervous look around and then starts the agonizing process of inching himself down the two or three steps to the grass. He now edges himself away into the surrounding bracken. He pulls himself inch by terrible inch across a patch of bare earth and pine needles overhung with fallen trees. Now wearing a pair of jeans below her shirt, the woman returns to the tool shed. The man continues struggling away. She looks around as if in panic or rage.
You bastard! Where are you?
She heads off into the mist.
Where are you?
He toils up a slope. She runs off among the blasted trees. He continues struggling uphill. Stopping dead on hearing her voice, he spots the old foxhole and begins crawling desperately towards it. He crawls on his back towards the old burrow and goes in head first. His feet and the whetstone are still sticking out as she appears among the trees above him. She stops on the bank just above the burrow entrance and crouches down, clutching her head with an expression of misery.
You said you wanted to help me! Where are you? Where are you?
Inside the burrow, the man strikes a match. He rotates his body painfully in the earthen tunnel. He holds up the lighted match and peers further down into the burrow. He shakes out the stub of the first match and lights another. His attention has been drawn to something in the floor of the burrow. He begins to carefully dig the soil away to reveal what appears to be the wing of a bird. The man stares down as if in incomprehension. The body of the bird which he has unearthed pulses gently as the creature breathes. He strikes another match. The crow stands staring at him.
You bastard!
She looks up on hearing the crow. In the burrow, he seems to fear the bird will give him away and kills it with a stone. She paces among the trees, listening for the crow and looking all around with her grim stare. The man examines the bird's body closely by the light of his dying match. Bizarrely, the bird revives. She casts around in the treetops to see where the sound is coming from. Beneath the ground, the man is making ever more desperate attempts to finish the bird off. She is standing on the top of the bank once more. She looks down towards the burrow entrance and spots his feet. She clambers down with awful purpose.
Get out! Get out! You bastard! Get out! You bastard! Come out! Come out!
Unable to pull him back out of the burrow, she now runs off frantically back to the tool shed. After a moment, she re-emerges, carrying a long-handled shovel. She runs back to the burrow and begins jabbing at his feet.
Get out! You bastard! Come out!
She dislodges a large rock held up by the tree roots, which now falls to cover the burrow entrance. She climbs back up onto the bank and starts to dig. The hole now collapses into the burrow. She continues frenziedly bringing the shovel down. Scrawl on a blackboard reads, Antichrist, Chapter 4, The Three Beggars. Nighttime. The woman stands among the straight pine trunks. She looks around and then down at the ground. Seemingly in some anguish, she crouches down and starts to dig with her hands. The man's face is framed in the hole she has dug. She carefully wipes soil from it. She bends down and seems to be trying to pull him up out of the hole. She pulls at his limp body. After a major effort, she succeeds in pulling him and the whetstone onto the bank.
We gotta get this thing off.
She returns to the shed and hunts in the box for the right tool. She looks around with concern. He lies there, semi-conscious. She returns to the bank.
I can't find the wrench.
She bends down and gets her hands under his armpits. She lifts him with difficulty. Upright now, but still seated on the ground, he struggles with the whetstone. She takes the heavy stone in both hands in an attempt to make it easier for him to shuffle towards the cabin. She gets him to the porch and up onto it. She drags him inside the cabin. She closes the door. She looks down at him with an edge of compassion.
Did you want to kill me?
Not yet. three beggars aren't here yet.
The three beggars? What does that mean?
When the three beggars arrive, someone must die.
I see.
She looks down at him and then presses her face down against his.
A crying woman is a scheming woman.
She pulls her hair back from her face and looks down at him with an insane glint in her eye.
False in legs, false in thighs, false in breast, teeth, hair and eyes.
She seems almost as if she is about to swoon. Instead, she swoops down and begins to kiss him on the mouth. He looks up at her as she gets up and moves away. She removes her jeans. She crosses and crouches by a cupboard, seeming to fetch something out of it. She walks slowly back to him, in her left hand a large pair of scissors. She lies down beside him on the bare floorboards. She takes his right hand and places it on her vagina. She begins to writhe against him. Her eyes open. She seems to recall being in bed with the man. In flashback, she looks across to see the child clambering up onto the chair by the table. She gives up his right hand and puts her own hand onto her vagina as she weeps, her eyes widening in fear. The child falls from the window, holding the teddy bear aloft. In flashback, the woman appears to be watching.
Hold me.
She picks up the scissors.
Hold me.
He reaches painfully across to her. As he does so, she appears to be teasing out the folds of her labia to make her clitoris stand out. She places the blades of the scissors around the fold of flesh. She cuts it off. In the forest, a deer looks round wide-eyed at her scream of agony. Bleeding badly, she convulses in pain. She edges away from the man, who seems to have passed out again. She sits up and looks towards the door. Outside now, she walks slowly and painfully away from the cabin. She kneels down in the moonlit grass. Inside the cabin, the man comes round again. His eyes open as he lies on his back. His gaze is drawn to the window through which he sees the bright firmament of stars, with the shape of one constellation very clearly defined. The star chart is superimposed onto this image, outlining the three beggars of pain, despair, and grief.
There's no such constellation.
The child falls from the window. Behind him in the room stands a deer. The man turns towards the doorway where the woman reappears, crouching.
None of it is any use. None of it is any use. No! No!
Hail falls heavily on the porch steps. The man looks wearily across. The woman lies bunched up on the porch. Behind her stands a deer. The man looks across as through the doorway pads a fox wearing a collar from which hangs a small brass bell. The man seems to shake his head as if he thinks he might be hallucinating. He sits up, bewildered on hearing the cawing of the bird. He looks down and then bangs on the floorboards. He bangs down with his elbow, finally succeeding in making a hole in the boards. In the space below the cabin, the crow flaps around and the wrench lies on the ground. As the crow flaps away to join the fox and the deer, who have all grouped themselves around the prone body of the woman out on the porch, the man reaches down for the wrench and begins freeing his leg. As he turns the wrench, releasing the nut from the long threaded spindle, he looks across at where the woman lies with her back to him and her eyes closed. The woman's eyes are now open. The man continues undoing the nut. She runs at him and stabs the scissors shallowly into his back. He pulls them out, and as she scurries away across the floor, bashes the spindle back out through his leg. She runs at him and they grapple, but he keeps hitting at the spindle with the wrench. She grabs the wrench. He pulls the spindle out through his leg with his bare hands. She gazes at him almost as if imploringly as he finally frees himself from the whetstone. He looks down at his leg, quivering in pain. He then shoots a sudden look across at her. He seems to see the bunch of hair at the back of her neck, her ear, her dilated pupil, as were highlighted earlier in her grieving process. He crosses, grabs her and pushes her against the cabin wall. She drops the scissors. He looks down, seeing her fingers pale and trembling, the swiftness of her breathing. He looks as if with horror at her face contorting as he squeezes her throat. He sees the pulse in her neck, but nevertheless applies more pressure with his thumbs. The veins in her forehead stand out. Her eyes bulge. Her tongue is swelling and her cheeks becoming puffy. He stares relentlessly at her. He closes his eyes. Hers have rolled upwards and she seems to have become a dead weight as her body slowly slides down the wall. In the light of dawn, he hobbles to pick up a can of petrol which he pours over her body set in a nest of branches. Bright motes of cinder rise from a huge blaze in the meadow by the cabin. The man seems to be limping away from the cabin up the pathway through the blasted trees with the aid of a stick. Pale shapes materialize on the ground around the path. They are heaped naked bodies like those of the damned in a painting by Bosch. A Against a background of violent zigzag chalk strokes, the words Antichrist and Epilogue are scrawled. In black and white, the man continues limping along on his improvised crutch. He sits to grab and hungrily eat berries from trailing brambles. Something seems to catch the man's eye. Among the brambles lie scattered the feathers of a crow. The man turns and sees the fox, the deer, and the crow standing at the forest edge, each one semi-transparent. The man turns and looks in the other direction, standing as he does so. He looks down a steep, tree-covered slope falling away below him. Walking towards him up the slope is a huge wave of women, all plainly dressed in skirts and cardigans. They continue unhurriedly up the hill towards him, and now also down the slope from behind him so that he is surrounded. The faces of the women have all been intentionally blurred out of focus. The entire wooded hillside is alive with slowly walking figures. The end.